Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of the Humble Podcast, the podcast that checks all egos at the door and whisks you backstage into the world of entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Charlie Lass, and today I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Walker Luttringer. We're going to begin this podcast series at the very beginning of the entrepreneur's journey and dispel some of the most common myths about launching your own venture.
So let's just jump right into it, Charlie. What's your favorite myth about entrepreneurship that you feel like a lot of people just get totally wrong?
I think it applies perfectly to this podcast. This being the first one and us not even having a proper title, the first one for me is that it has to be perfect, that you can't launch anything until you've got the idea totally sorted and everything's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, you just got to start and get it and get something on there, right? I think for you, it's the ugly baby concept. You know, a lot of people have a different name for it, but that's kind of where it goes. Just start and make it happen.
Yeah. So this is the first of our podcast. Most people don't make it past, I think it's 12 or 13 episodes. We're determined to get past that.
Yeah.
We're going to have a series of guests throughout the year, but we're going to always come back to the entrepreneurial journey throughout.
My favorite myth that I like to talk about is only 2% of startups get funding from external sources. You know, people just assume that every startup, you know, at least 50% of them are funded by external sources, but 98% of startups in America are bootstrapped, funded by founders' credit cards, personal savings.
Really?
And it's just such a myth because you see so much content about funding and funding sources and how to get funding and how to do the perfect pitch. And that only applies to 2% of businesses being started. It's insane.
It's the first question that people always ask when in like office hours or people approaching us with Humble is, how do I get funding? I need $2 million to launch my cupcake business.
So where do you want to go? Where do you want to go with this on the miss? I mean, you've got to have some that you see all the time with talking to young entrepreneurs for sure.
All the time. Next one is that competition is bad. If you come up with an idea and you search for it and you start to find that it doesn't exist, there's probably two reasons. One is that it's terrible and no one wants it. And two is that no one's thought of it, but it's very unlikely to be the second one. It's most likely that if something doesn't exist, it's because the market doesn't actually want it. Or in the case of a friend of mine who came up with the idea for contact lenses that were UV reflective, like sunglasses for your eyeballs. He started researching it and found out that Johnson & Johnson have the patent for it and they're just sitting on it. And that's like the third option. But if you've got competition, if you've got other people who are doing it in a slightly different way, that's validation. It shouldn't be a threat.
I agree. When I talk to entrepreneurs and they say, you know, I ask them like, who's your competition? And they're like, I don't have any. That's a big red flag because it means somebody's already tried to do it and failed miserably, so it doesn't work, or you didn't do the proper research to find out that there really is competition out there, you know, or you don't really understand the market well enough, because it's very unlikely that you're starting a company that does not exist, like some concept that just does not exist. That's very unlikely.
It is. It's also quite risky, even more risky than actually launching a venture for the first time anyway. One of my first enterprises was a company called ViaPost, which was a hybrid mail system. And the education that we had to go through with our customers to explain what it did was impossible. And it was a little bit too advanced for what we were trying to do. You know, a slight improvement on an existing process is where most of the most successful new ventures start. They find something that's a little bit broken and they fix it a bit, rather than totally reinventing something for the most part.
That's kind of the way it goes. You know, I mean, these companies start out and they have to learn, right? I mean, you've got to learn what you don't know. And as a young entrepreneur, those are the things you don't even realize.
The next myth, and this is the biggest, the 24/7 hustle culture, that if you don't work 200 hours a day and sacrifice your friends and family and everything else around you, then you're not taking this seriously. And it is the most toxic attitude that entrepreneurs are force-fed, fetishizing this constant work attitude that damages a lot of people's sanity, certainly their mental health, and inevitably their success as well. You burn out far faster.
I hate this myth. I really do. This is one of the most self-destructive myths I think that exists in entrepreneurship, because it actually goes against all the research that shows how a human being is productive. right? You cannot sustain a startup by being that whole hustle culture of that 24/7, burn yourself out, you're working till 4 a.m. That is just not the way to build one of these businesses. I think it, you know, it gives the idea that somehow these businesses are built in a matter of months. Man, this is a marathon, right?
Yeah. Come up with an idea and you're on the cover of Forbes next week. It just doesn't happen.
That's exactly right.
It doesn't just affect entrepreneurs. It affects those around entrepreneurs. If they see someone, you know, taking a break or taking a day off, oh, you're not taking this seriously. You're not working hard enough. I'm like, well,
yep.
Kind of think about this. I think about this all the time. Like, this is my job. This is my career. And, you know, the metrics for success are so binary in lots of people's eyes that, you know, you've got to take a break eventually. And when someone sees an entrepreneur who, by the way, is much more likely to have ADD, mental health and substance abuse issues anyway, they don't work in normal ways. This is not a normal job, certainly not 9 to 5. And so when someone isn't working in an orthodox way and then they're perceived to be lazy, it's even more destructive. And then the entrepreneur feels guilty. And then it just goes round and round and round.
Absolutely. And I mean, the stress you're putting on your personal relationships, whether that's your friends, your family, your wife, your kids, when you have that kind of mindset, it is infectious, and it can actually affect the people around you and propel them away from you because they realize how toxic it is and they just don't want to be a part of it. And when you're an entrepreneur, you need all the emotional support that you can get from anywhere that you can get it. I mean, let's face it. It is a exercise in futility when you're trying to build a startup. And so by having that hustler mentality, you're propelling the people you need.
Yeah, totally. And entrepreneurs definitely need to reach out for help and ask for support. Not a lot of people who haven't been through it know actually a way in which they can usefully respond. And we're seeing a lot of that. And we'll have a contributor to this podcast in the coming weeks who's a mental health professional who is steering into working with a lot of entrepreneurs because, you know, you go to a therapist, fine, but they may not have any experience or knowledge of what you're really going through. The only people that do are entrepreneurs, and they're not licensed therapists. They're not, you know, mental health professionals. But what we are seeing is a lot of people who are finally, maybe it was COVID that did it, actually saying this shit is hard, like really hard. And it's not quick and it's not certain. And having the ability, knowing that you can actually take a step back and take a break without being judged for it, is a really important part of progress.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next one.
This is a bit subjective, but people saying it's all about the money. The entrepreneurs, the only reason that people launch their own business is because of the financial gain that is, you know, waiting just around the corner. Well, firstly, you know, most entrepreneurs aren't billionaires. It's a way of providing flexibility and freedom in a certain capacity, but it doesn't have to involve millions and millions of dollars coming into the business or your family every year.
Yeah, I feel like this is an example of where a few characters are driving a narrative that's been applied to the whole field. Of course, there are going to be these one-off people that are all in it for the money, right?
Right.
But from a cultural standpoint of entrepreneurship, I rarely see entrepreneurs that are in it for the money. It's almost like they're in it to prove a point. They want to prove themselves, right? They want to prove that their idea is right. They've got this idea. They know there's something there. It really doesn't have anything to do with the money. I mean, Charlie, how many startups have you seen where you're just like, this is an incredible idea that you can never make money at, right? I mean, yeah. I see them all the time. And right. That's not a reason not to pursue it.
No, I mean, there's a study from the MIT Innovation Initiative that ranked, through a bunch of surveys, ranked the highest motivators for entrepreneurs, and money was about number 7. You know, top of the list was solving a problem or working in my own way or, you know, other things like that. But, you know, a financial motivator, there's that old adage that if all you're in it for is the money, that's the last thing you'll make.
Yeah.
And it's kind of true because you can't really build a sustainable thing. It's a sustainable business if you're just chasing cash, and you could be making fidget spinners. And we all saw how that went.
it really, when you're chasing the money, it does an incredible job of corrupting the solution that you've come up with or what you want to pursue. I mean, it just kind of takes it down a rabbit hole of death by a thousand cuts.
Yep. I mean, you're launching something to solve a problem or create a joy. And there isn't a financial outcome in that. And if your customers sense that, and they eventually will, it's going to collapse. But if you are solving a problem, if you are creating, you know, joy, then it stands a much better chance of succeeding. Okay, speaking of succeeding, myth number next is failure is not an option. Now, there's a cultural aspect to this. In the UK, if you fail as an entrepreneur, you are very much a failed entrepreneur. And that stigma is quite difficult to shake. Whereas in the US, you know, some venture funds won't touch you unless you've crashed and burned before.
Yeah, it's really interesting. From British culture, like, they don't tolerate failure very well, right? No. And I would say that that has transmitted over to American culture as well from a broad populist standpoint. However, we tend to like the underdog a little better than the Brits do. And we celebrate the downfall of these big companies a little more than the Brits do.
Oh, we love an underdog.
You do?
Yeah. I mean,
is that because you're always the underdog?
Well, at the moment, yeah. Any team playing against Man City is basically the people, one of the people support, or any F1 driver that isn't Max Verstappen. Like, we'll just support someone, because, anybody else, because the person is winning too much. We love an underdog.
Yeah.
There isn't a forgiveness. That's for sure.
I will say that this is where the finance guys do get it right. I mean, I think that VCs and investors, other organizations, they really understand that entrepreneurship is a path of failure, and adapting to failure is one of the critical success factors as a founder. And if you can't do that, you're not going to be a very effective entrepreneur.
Yeah. There's a couple of examples that I'm not going to specifically mention, but a friend of mine, this is like 20 years ago, he came up with one of the first advertising websites. And it was an instant overnight success. And he made, you know, £1 million in 6 weeks. The difficult second album, like, he couldn't repeat the trick. And he didn't know what to do. He couldn't actually wrap his head around it. And it took him a long time to recover and realize that, you know, the first one was a fluke, well-timed and well-executed, but still a fluke. And then delivering it a second time, he couldn't do it.
Yeah, the best example I know of, I think it's Flickr and Slack. Those were both born out of failure. The founder, I can't remember his name, but he wanted to build a video game. The video game was not that popular, but the photo sharing option feature in that video game was super popular. And so they spun it out into a company, which became a huge success. And after that success, he went back and he said, I'm building this video game again. So he built the video game again. And this time the best feature was the chat function. The video game still sucked, but the chat function was amazing. And they spun that out into Slack.
Yeah, it was the internal chat function for the dev team.
That's right. So, like, if that's not a perfect example of you need to be able to accept failure, then I don't really know what is.
Yeah, and he sold us his Salesforce for like $36 billion or something crazy. We should probably fact check that. The other one, so pivoting is so important, and it isn't necessarily done because something has gone wrong. It's because there's a better opportunity out there. I mean, Nintendo launched 105 years ago making playing cards. And they have evolved into what they are now because that was the best allocation of their resources throughout their history.
Right.
Okay.
Next myth.
It's all beaches and boats. I mean, the toxic poster child for this is Dan Bilzerian, where it's just Instagram showreel of bullshit that says, if you're not this, then you've failed. And it really, really messes with people's heads.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the social media is proved to be very destructive in this type of application, meaning that you're showing the highlights of your life, and, you know, that may be 5% of your actual time. You're not showing the 95% that was not so great, right? So, like, you know, how many times did you have to do something to get that 2-minute clip that you put on Instagram or whatever it is? Or, you know, you woke up that day and you didn't feel great, or, you know, you couldn't get out of bed. There's a million things that happen behind the scenes. And with entrepreneurship, you can't really do a day in the life, right? Because that's just not a practical way to think about your life as an entrepreneur. I mean, it kind of goes back to that hustle mentality myth, right? The best thing you can do for yourself if you want to pursue entrepreneurship is invest in understanding work-life balance. Because if you don't do that, you will not have the mental strength to be able to be a successful founder. You just won't be able to power through the hard times.
Yeah, the mental success comes from all of these points we just mentioned. Resilience is probably the trait that is most important, which means rolling with the punches. My favorite example of it not all being beaches and boats is WD-40. You know what it stands for?
No clue. I use it all the time. I have no clue what it stands for.
It's water displacement version 40. That means there are 39 other versions that don't work.
That's right.
And it's ubiquitous. And they put it in the bloody name. I love it.
Yeah.
You just keep going, refining the idea, refining the process, and you know, hopefully eventually that'll work.
Yeah.
But it's aspiring to, you know, that Instagram showreel is exhausting, and promoting the Instagram showreel is eventually toxic. The people, you know, there's so many studies and stories out there of people who are, you know, wrecking their own happiness because they're trying to portray a false image of their success or their journey. And you know, there's a huge argument for authenticity and humility.
I would say if you think that it can be beaches and boats, if you live in a beach town and you own a canoe, like then it can be beaches and boats, right? But other than that, for the first few years, it's going to, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
The only entrepreneur to successfully get out after one. $500 million, and it's just his Instagram now is just pictures of him around the world.
That's right.
On him.
Yeah.
But for the most of us, it's not.
Charlie, I think that everybody in the entrepreneurial community that's tried to help entrepreneurs have been in these weird, awkward situations with an entrepreneur where they're trying to pitch you or tell you about their business, and you're not cringing, but you're like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best thing. So why don't you give us some scenarios of ones that like come to your mind, and we'll talk about those.
Okay. I like to use the analogy that pitching or raising money is a lot like dating. And the biggest red flag is when people try and get married on that first date. They bring all of their stuff. The pitch deck is 30 slides long. They've brought an overnight bag. And they've already booked the honeymoon. Like this is, you're getting ahead of yourself. You have to find the right balance, especially when raising money from individuals. This is a long-term thing that you're entering into, and it has to be useful for both people. It's when people focus on just getting that check and everything will be fine. Like, as soon as I get this money, everything's fixed. Like actually, no, as soon as you get any money in, that's when the real work starts. And you've just signed up to be in a relationship with this person for probably 5 or 6 years if you're raising, you know, seed round. And you want to make sure you know the person a little bit better. Otherwise, it's going to be a rocky road that, you know, it's very difficult to get divorced from investors.
My favorite one is, I've had this happen a few times. It's even well before that, right? You just meet the person and they want you to sign an NDA before they even tell you what their idea is, right? And yeah. I had somebody that I respect really, really a lot tell me once that an NDA is all it is an invitation to a lawsuit. That's all it is, right? And so nobody signs NDAs, especially in those scenarios. And even if you wanted to try to sue somebody, you would have to have an obscene amount of money to actually make any progress doing it.
Yeah.
So it makes me laugh, but it is kind of a hard one to understand, though, because if you're a newbie, you don't really know. You've heard the term NDA,
right?
But you don't really know that how they're used. You may have seen them maybe in a corporate job or something, right? But for the most part, I mean, they're kind of useless.
They are kind of useless. But there is a situation where they are useful, and it's not at the beginning. If someone approaches an investor and goes, oh, before I tell you this idea, sign this NDA, that just sends off all the wrong signals. Firstly, is a massive flag for inexperience, because it's the execution of the idea, not the idea. Ideas are worthless. And if you think that this idea is so easy for somebody else to take and execute brilliantly on, you've got much bigger problems than an NDA.
Yep.
So in an early stage investment, they're not investing in the idea nearly as much as investing in the person. And so the NDA doesn't really do anything except piss people off. The only time that I think is useful is later on, when you're making some progress, maybe you're 3-6 months in, and as part of internal governance of your business, you want to make sure that some confidentiality agreements have been signed by the people that you're really sharing the secret sauce with. At that point, an NDA as part of a service agreement or a contract would be absolutely standard. And a lot of investors would after the fact say, oh, well, hang on, you didn't do this. You didn't implement an NDA at this stage. You probably should do that, because then you've got something to protect, and the person is in a situation where they've been given, you know, trade secrets, and you do want some coverage. And even if you don't have to, it's not something that you could legally enforce. It shows that you've taken that step seriously, especially when you're using investors' money. They go, hang on, you didn't even get an NDA signed by this guy, and now he's run off with all the stuff.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether or not you could actually chase him. It's that you didn't even think of it. You didn't do it. So when asking for money, I wouldn't say an NDA is very useful. When building your business, I think they're essential as part of a bigger, confidentiality, yeah, do not steal my stuff kind of agreement.
And I think the scenario you just brought up is most notably applied to IP, non-disclosures. Right. But I will say that there is one caveat where NDAs and other types of legal agreements are absolutely imperative. And that's when you're dealing with some kind of proprietary process that you have developed, let's say chemical or biological, or you're dealing with some brand new technology. But if you're just hiring some developers from some development house to build something, that's not proprietary technology most of the time. They're not inventing new code. But, you know, they're using off-the-shelf functionalities that already exist, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I know that our shared legal acquaintance will probably hate this, but the same sort of applies to, in my view, patents. Like trademarks, I think, are pretty useful. But patents is something that, you know, requires some real thought. And it isn't this fait accompli, you must do it, and you must do it at the beginning. There are a couple of big reasons for it. Firstly, it takes forever, and it's expensive. You know, yep, we're not talking like 6 month process, it's like 18 months to 2 years. And during that time, you know, you've got your secret widget, you've got the flux capacitor, you have to explain everything about that thing in public, basically giving anybody who's got the, you know, greater resources and greater experience than you, the ability to, like, oh, that's a great idea, thanks very much. And then they just take it. And then you don't have a patent, you don't have a product, and somebody else who's further along the line is using what you're doing. And a lot of companies, you know, will spend a lot. IBM has an entire patent division that it sounds like an amazing job. Sit in a, you know, room, drink some beers, come up with some weird ideas and patent them. That's what they do. Maybe not the beers bit. But they register anything that comes to mind and then sue people who came up with something similar, who don't have the resources to protect them. And then IBM, like, oh, cool, we'll launch this now.
I was just going to say that is the key issue right there, is your patent is only as good as your ability to sue somebody. If you do not have the resources to go to court and sue somebody in a lawsuit that's going to take 10 years plus, then, you know, you really need to think about the usefulness of that patent, because it just takes a lot of resources to enforce it.
Yeah. One of the most famous examples of people having to risk everything and damn near go bankrupt to defend their idea is James Dyson. I mean, I think it was Hoover who were like, oh, that's a great idea, thanks very much.
Yeah.
And he was like, wait, that's mine. And he had to invest everything into just protecting his innovation. And eventually he won, and now look at him. But
yeah,
like that is an atypical example, because it actually worked.
Right.
There are tens of thousands of other examples. And you also, you're assuming that a patent law, I mean, we're talking of something that has to be really technical. and really innovative. And the, you know, the patent process is, it has to be non-obvious and new.
Yeah.
Right. Do you think the Chinese care what American patent laws say? Probably not.
Yep.
Right. And you, all you've done is give them a head start.
Right. So you've done the groundwork.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the geographical limitations of patents. Again, you know, not legal advice, and lawyers will probably hate this, but from an entrepreneur's perspective, like, you have a finite amount of resources. The thing that is going to protect your business far greater than a bit of paper is customers and brand awareness and, you know, a process that allows you to get to market.
100%.
Later on, you might want to start protecting it. But if your first idea is to go to the patent office and drop $30,000 and reveal all the secrets, it's probably not the best idea.
Yeah. And we're not saying that there's not a case scenario for those. Of course, 100%. There are businesses that have been built on patents, and that's super critical. But the percentage of those businesses that exist and are started on a yearly basis is probably less than 1%.
Let's use Humble as an example, right? So Humble is a media platform that people can go onto and consume information that is niche and valuable and useful, and we have a free and a paid side of it. Well, I've just basically described YouTube as well. Like, there is the application to a specific market of a very useful product doesn't mean it is patentable.
Yeah.
That's where your customer base and the information and the quality of your product actually matters.
So I think we're running a little bit on time constraint here, but I wanted to cover two topics that I have been put in the position of. I don't know about you, Charlie, but there are multiple times when I've been trapped at an event with an entrepreneur who will talk about their business for like an hour and not stop. And I've had that happen multiple times, and you know they do it to every single person they meet. Yeah. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, I just feel like in my core, you need to have a 1 minute, 2 minute pitch so that you can actually have a conversation with somebody.
I mean, that's why the elevator pitch is so important.
Yeah.
And we've got an upcoming segment where we're going to be reviewing entrepreneurs' elevator pitches in an elevator, but that's for a later day.
Yeah. And I think with that, Charlie, you want to wrap up, kind of talk a little bit about the podcast and maybe how people can give us some feedback.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening to our inaugural podcast. It's been a lot of fun making. We will continue to do this every week. Check out this and other content from experts around the world at humble.inc. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Thank you so much.